This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Anna Jean Mayhew was born and raised in Charlotte. At 45, she moved to the Triangle. And it was then she realized how much she wanted to write about Charlotte. Anna Jean, or AJ as she is known, had no formal training as a writer, but she had stories to tell. She joined a writing group and set to work on what is now the acclaimed novel, The Dry Grass of August. The book tells the story of the Watts family through the eyes of their 13-year-old daughter, Juby. The family's traveling without their father from Charlotte to Pensacola, Florida. Their African-American maid, Mary, is with them. It's the summer of 1954, just after the landmark Brown versus the Board of Education Supreme Court case. It's a coming-of-age story about Juby and about the South. AJ is proud to be a debut novelist in her 70s and joins me today to share the secret of her success. AJ Mayhew, welcome to the State of Things. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be here.
And congratulations. Now, we know how many years you have been in the making, but what about the novel? How long did it take you to write this book?
I wrote the first paragraph in 1987. I was lucky enough to get into a group of writers in Chapel Hill led by novelist Laurel Goldman. I'm still in that group, by the way, 23 years later. And I wrote, I started it, and it grew over the years. It took me 18 years to finish it.
Did you know it was the first paragraph of a novel, or was it an exercise at the time?
I didn't know it was not an exercise. I did not know it was the first paragraph of a novel. I knew it was something I wanted to write about, and I thought, I'll just write it down and see what happens.
Had you written much before this?
Yes, I'd had a short story published nationally, but it was science fiction. I had not done mainstream fiction. I had written, but not anything that got published before that. And after I got the short story published, I thought, this feels good. I'm going to try it. So
here we are.
Yeah.
Tell us more about the experience in this workshop working with Laurel Goldman.
It's been absolutely amazing. There are three members of that original group who are still there. I mean, Laurel and I and Cindy Paris. And the other members, several of them have published novels. The beautiful thing about getting into a group with your peers or better is and staying in is that you can trust each other. And I know now that when I get critique, it's only to make my book better, only to make my writing better. There's no backbiting or jealousy. It's wonderful.
How much of this book was part of that process? In other words, was it the focus, or did it come in and out as you went through the years?
It did come in and out. I don't think I've been asked that before. I did work on other things over the years, but it never let me go. So I never let it go. I kept picking it back up.
Well, let's talk a bit about this book.
You say
you start with character.
I do.
Your characters. And your character, Juby. Tell us about her.
Yes. Juby, June Bentley Watts. She's 13. She's got that still that wonderful edge of innocence of 13, but she's also maturing into a young woman. And she's beginning to think for herself and to see things around her. And I was attracted to her from the beginning. She was partly me at first, but I had to really let go of myself and listen to Juby.
And you're listening to Juby, but when did it come to you that this plot needed to be set in 1954, that it would be about this journey from Charlotte to Pensacola?
That was pretty much from the beginning.
Yeah.
It was based on a trip my family took, but only loosely based. And we did not travel with the domestic on that trip. And I don't remember that it was in 1954, but a lot of the things that happened along the way happened when I was about Juby's age.
So tell us more about Juby's parents now.
Okay. Bill Watts, her father, runs a concrete fabrications company in Charlotte. He is a philanderer, and he drinks a lot. He also has a tug in him to be a good father. He's complicated, like a lot of people. And Paula I really love what you said to me earlier, that she is aware of the inequities in the black-white situation at that time. But she's also aware that that situation supports her lifestyle. And she's loath to give that up.
It supports her lifestyle, and it also puts her in the position of being subservient and is oppressive
Absolutely.
To her at the same time.
Absolutely.
Something that doesn't come quite so clear to her, at least as I read the book, mm-hmm. Until she takes this trip with Judy
That's
and
true.
Mary. Well,
That's
now
true.
Tell us a little about Mary.
Mary Luther. She's 47 years old. She's a widowed mother of two children. She has worked for this family for about 7 years, and she's quite direct and forthcoming with Juby. However, if she's speaking to Bill Watts, Mr. Watts, her eyes are cast down, and she's yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. And she becomes what a teenager who read my book, an African-American teenager, described as a female Uncle Tom, which bothered me at the time. And later I thought, wait a minute, that child who read the book would never have known these subservient black women who worked in white homes. So her description of female Uncle Tom was apt.
Or the pressures they were under and
That's
the system
right.
that they worked under had they not sort of gotten this look at that life. And Juby, of course, is in a sense unaware of this. She knows no other way of
right.
life either. And this is a woman who she loves dearly, who the
right.
family seems to, you know, honor in some way. She's a mm-hmm. part of the family. And it's not until they go on this trip
right.
that her eyes are open. Will you read for us?
Oh,
will
I'd
you read
love
for
to.
Us? Thank you.
So this will be Juby as protagonist, first person. In August of 1954, we took our first trip without Daddy, and Stell got to use the driver's license she'd had such a fit about. It was just a little card saying she was Estelle Annette Watts, that she was white, with hazel eyes and brown hair. But her having a license made that trip different from any others, because if she hadn't had it, we never would have been stuck in Sally's Motel Park in Claxton, Georgia, where we went to buy fruitcakes and had a wreck instead, and Mary would still be with us. Stell and I carried the last of the suitcases to the driveway. The sky was a wide, far blue above the willow oaks that lined Queens Road West, with no promise of rain to break the heat. I put Mary's flowered cloth bag in the trunk and Daddy took it out. I always start with the biggest piece. He picked up Mama's Pullman and grunted. She packed like she's never coming back. He hefted it into the trunk, then looked at the luggage still sitting by the car and ran his hand through his hair, which was oily with Brill cream and sweat. 95 and not even 10 o'clock. He wiped his face with his pocket handkerchief and pushed his wire-rimmed glasses back in place. Mary came down the back walk, Davy on her hip. Puddin stumbled along beside them, struggling with the small suitcase she'd gotten for Christmas. Daddy said to Mama, "Don't let Mary ride up front." "I'd never do such a fool thing," Mama said.
A.J. Mayhew reading from her new novel, The Dry Grass of August. And there it is, the first glimpse of what would be many horrific events along the way that opened Juby's eyes. Mm-hmm. Tell us more. Give us some more a sense of the events that happen and how Juby evolves and has her eyes open in this trip.
As they're traveling, she sees signs along the road that she begins to think about, signs such as "Segregation ain't broke, don't fix it." This was when the South was beginning to react to Brown v. Board. And they get to Florida, where they go to visit one of her favorite uncles, her mother's brother. And she begins to see signs that Uncle Taylor is also a bit of a racist, although he's also complicated. He's a good man, and he's a product of his upbringing. And because of Juby's fondness for him, it's disturbing to her to see these things in Uncle Taylor. And in Florida, she meets a boy. She's been wanting to meet a boy, and she does, at a traveling circus that they visit. And he is African-American, and they really like each other. And this cannot be, not in 1954. So that's one of the events. That's a pretty major event for Juby. As they get back on the road, as they travel, they can't find places where Mary can spend the night. If she has to use the bathroom, it'll either be the bathroom of the help at a restaurant or an outhouse behind a filling station. At one point, Juby says, "Don't you want a Coca-Cola?" And Mary says, "No, I don't know when I'll find another outhouse." Those things open Juby's eyes. I won't talk about the major event because I don't want to spoil the book, but
Well, the what you've captured beautifully, I think, is here is a young person, in this case, Juby, a young girl, on the threshold of adulthood, someone who is forming their identity. And mm-hmm. things go along pretty smoothly. You have people in the family. These are the people you identify mm-hmm. with. You take on their characteristics and move forward. And in this crucial, vulnerable moment of establishing your own identity, you realize that they are doing things that are completely wrong. And right. now who do I look to? Because the other people I've respected aren't very well respected in this society.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You just captured it.
Well, you captured it, and you did it in the novel, and here's what that started from a character. So I want you to talk, please, about how this character evolved for you and how the complexity of all of that begins. If it starts with a character, how do those other elements, do they unfold, or do you see them, are you packing them into the character, I guess?
It's going to sound almost, sort of Twilight Zone, that these people start talking to me and I take dictation. Some of my most vivid scenes have come from me hearing voices literally at like 2:00 in the morning. I wake up and this person is talking to me and I'll grab my pad off the bedside table and I often have to get up and go to the computer. But those turn out to be just incredible scenes. And I have to polish them and, you know, get them down out of the 2:00 in the morning writing mode. But it's a process where, for me, when I get this character and the character's living and breathing, she'll do something that I didn't expect. And it startles me, and I just kind of follow her down the road to see what she's going to do next.
Ever argue with your characters?
Uh-huh. Well, I try to make them stop doing what they're doing, and it never works. Never works.
Is it because you don't know how that's going to turn out? You say, I can't figure out where this is going to go.
Yeah. And I want plot. You know, I think, I should have an outline. I should know where this is going. And whenever I've tried to write to outline, the characters have become wooden. Mm-hmm. I can't do it. I did try to write a book to an outline. I outlined the whole thing.
Didn't work.
It never got lively. It didn't have that life in it that a true character will give it.
I'd be curious to know if in the process of writing that book, the outline book, if the voices stopped, if you didn't hear voices.
I didn't.
There you go.
Oh, that's amazing. I had not thought of that. I did not.
What do you think is going on there? What's happening? These are experiences that are not yours. This is not an autobiography. You're experienced in the world. How do they collect in some part of your mind that can only know what you have experienced, honestly?
I don't know if I can know that because what happens at like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning is certainly subconscious, maybe coming out of a dream state. But if I had not lived some of these things, I couldn't write with that ring of truth. So I don't really know the answer to it.
Best not to explore that too deeply, or the voices may stop again.
That's
sorry,
right.
Sorry I asked. There's this term that I think is exposed amplified in this mm-hmm. book, this idea of the Deep South, which excludes North Carolina. It's not mm-hmm. quite the same. The trip is from North Carolina to mm-hmm. Pensacola. We have to go mm-hmm. deeper in the South. Mm-hmm. Are there differences along the way in those locations?
Several people have written that in reviews of my book, and I didn't see it that way. I saw North Carolina as a pit of segregation and discrimination just as well as the Deep South. But it was on that trip into the South where things, I think, had a harder edge, a sharper edge. Not that there was less discrimination, but it was more visible. And that's why Juby becomes aware of it.
Could she have become aware of it if she'd stayed in Charlotte?
Absolutely. I'm convinced of that. And she does see it in her own home. I mean, there's a toilet without even a lid on it under the stairs in the basement for Mary and the yard man. And I think after the trip is when Juby begins to question the inequity of those things.
What about Paula? Did she have to get outside of Charlotte to realize that she was a victim of the very thing that had privileged her?
I think perhaps so, although I hope she would have come to it in Charlotte. She's the character who, for me, changes the most in the book. And she comes to realize that she does have choices. She feels tied by Bill's money and his position in Charlotte. It's when she's willing to let go of that she gets to be free. And I hope she could have done that in Charlotte eventually, but the events on the trip certainly did jolt her out of her complacency.
And what the story does for me is reveal the depth and the breadth of the structure that holds them all in place. If it's just racism, I'm going to dismiss that as though it's nothing. Racism and segregation, we feel we're familiar with that and understand the causes. But then to see how deeply rooted it is and how widespread the effects are through this other character, understanding what's happened to her, I think is a real revelation.
Well, that plus Paula's awareness of her husband's infidelity and her willingness to go along with it. I mean, you know, she stopped sleeping with him for a year, but she still stayed with him and kind of turned the other cheek.
Because she couldn't figure out what else she would do.
She couldn't. Right? And she did give in and go back to him. But she eventually wakes up to what that has cost her.
Mm-hmm. And looks for options.
Yeah.
Juby's father, let's talk about him, he is abusive. He's not a particularly sympathetic character.
No. And at the same time, I hope by the end of the book I have showed that he does recognize his role in things. He has been the rooster, I mean the cock of the walk. He has been able to name all of his own ways and what he wants and how to get it. But by the end of the book, I think he's deeply shaken by a particular event that happens and comes to realize he's got some changing to do. Whether he does change or not, I don't really know.
That's the sequel.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
Well, are there admirable male characters in this book, do you think?
Oh, yes, absolutely. His brother, Stamos Watts, is just a wonderful man who cannot deal with the guilt he has over something that he and his brother ultimately wind up being responsible for.
The Dry Grass of August, where does the title come from?
From a poem by Robert Penn Warren. The book was originally called Steal Away Home, and it was quite an apt title given the plot, but there are five or six other books out there by that title. So I went into a search to find a title, and I found this amazing poem by Robert Penn Warren called Starfall.
How much did that first paragraph change in the final rendering of this book?
Almost not at all.
Wow.
I had in the first line that she was 13, and I had that the driver's license still had such a hissy fit about, and I took out the word hissy. A couple of other teeny little changes.
Wow.
I put in the word white. That her driver's license said that she was Estelle Annette Watts, that she was white. And that turned out, of course, to be just very important.
Very important.
Yeah.
In the book. So what are you working on?
Oh, I owe another book to my publisher.
And us.
And, oh, thank you. And it's called Tomorrow's Bread. It's from a poem by Langston Hughes. And it takes place 16 years later in 1970. It's not a sequel. None of the same characters come in. But it, again, is set in Charlotte. And again, it deals with segregation integration. It took 16 years to integrate the Charlotte elementary schools. It's about the urban renewal that was taking place that was uprooting huge number of black neighborhoods in downtown Charlotte and forced busing. And my children were on the first bus out of the suburbs, so it's a topic I'm really familiar with.
We're looking forward to it.
Thank you.
AJ, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank.
Anna Jean Mayhew's debut novel is called The Dry Grass of August. She's going to be reading at Quail Ridge Books March 30th, and she has appearances. When's it?
March 29th.
March 29th at Quail Ridge. Anyway, here's the big thing to do. You need to go to ajmm.net, and then you're going to find out all the information. But we know that she has appearances later this spring at The Regulator, Flyleaf, McIntyre's, and Purple Crow Books. So go to ajmm.net for all that information. Coming up on The State of Things, the Bullfrog, Willard McGee, plays live. Stay tuned.